Paper 32, section 3, which is old single column, page 360. And, okay, so remember what the title of this paper is, The Evolution of Local Universes. And those first two sections that we've now gone through, you know, were very much kind of just directly that, you know, in the way you would kind of initially think of it, the evolution in a physical sense of the local universes. In a sense, we're kind of flipping it around now, kind of going from the extensive to the intensive. This is more local universe evolution. And so when you look at the title of section 3, The Evolutionary Idea, the first thing is just to notice that last word, what the noun is. It's not ideal. The title of the section is not The Existential Ideal. It is The Evolutionary Idea. And more and more, as you get into the fifth epical revelation, you should know right up front that that contrast is, you know, between the lines. That's the subtext of that title. The evolutionary idea in contrast to the existential ideal. And because that's what the subtext that you ought to recognize, you ought to recognize another thing that's not directly stated there. Warning. Okay. You're about to enter a section which is not going to conform with the entire history of the idea of God, which has been very much limited to initial attempts to think about the ideal of God, and in a more scholarly mode, the existential ideal of God, and a whole history of culture about ideas of God, you know, predicated on that. You know, so I'm not just saying it to be funny. I mean, it's very serious. It's warning. What you're about to read is not for those who are not ready to take on the challenge of what the fifth epical revelation is putting forward. It's not going to affirm your old ideas of God. You know, what's the very first paragraph in the book say? You know, that there's an issue with your ideas of God. And so here it is, coming up. We're going to boldly strike into that. And, you know, just to emphasize how we're not in the fourth epical mode when we're talking about the idea of God, especially when we're going to aggressively challenge, basically your most cherished ideas of the sacred. You know, you have to think about what Jesus told the apostles about what mode they were supposed to be in putting forward the fourth epical revelation. You know, he told them point blank, quote, "It matters little what idea of the Father you may entertain, as long as you are spiritually acquainted with the ideal of his infinite and eternal nature." Because he's preparing the way. He's doing step one. There's no way to get in to the rugged truths of proper, correct, right ideas of God. If you don't first have a firm hold on the ideal of His infinite and eternal nature, if that is still shakeable, if you aren't inconcussable, as the revelators like to say, you don't want to go into the next section that we're about to read. And like so many sections in the fifth epical revelation, they're not going to play that gentle first step like Jesus was playing and encouraging his apostles to go out with to get things started, where you just leave all of the hodgepodge of ideas, you know, which are basically all false. You just leave all those ideas be, you know, let them be as they are. Try to get them to really get a hold of a genuine grip on the ideal of an infinite, eternal God, not some anthropomorphic, you know, thing, yeah, but the real God. And 2,000 years have passed, and now it's time to be more than a child. You know, that's the recognition. A child can handle the ideal of God, but a child can't handle the rigors of a genuine idea of God for two reasons. One, it's very complex, and you have to actually be able to have some ability to have abstract thought, you know, to even go there. And then on top of that, inexorably, you've picked up ideas of God, and you know, and if you're not literally a biologic child anymore, if you're well into biologic adulthood, you know, you've been living your life relative to some definitive ideas about God. You know, they may be very, very intense in your mind, very specific ideas about God that you deem to be absolute. Yeah, well, the revelators don't care about such things. You know, and more than the revelators do, I'm trying to do that. You know, warning, you know, it's a serious warning, not for those timid souls. Okay, so let's get into this. You know, the point is to not be a sledgehammer, of course, but the point is to recognize that I'm being asked by the revelators to be courageous and independent of the whole history of mankind's thought, and to take on a whole new way of thinking about God. Apparently, a way that if I embrace will help address the emergency situation that put this book in my lap. I mean, if this whole fixation on the idea of God rather than the ideal wasn't relevant to that emergency, that wouldn't be the first and all the way through and the last thing that they say. Idea, 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 idea. So, you know, that's what the whole point is. So obviously, you know, it's hard enough for mankind to even get their mind wrapped around evolution in any domain. But, you know, to directly bring it into play and thinking about God, now that's forbidden territory, obviously. Okay, so warning. All right, so let's get into it a little bit. See if we're ready to courageously and put the basic elements of the fourth epical revelation mandate in the rearview mirror and boldly go out, you know, out of the sheltered bay. See what happens when we go out on the high seas. See what's there. All right.
Okay. This is paper 32, section 3, the evolutionary idea. The only creation that is perfectly settled is Havona, the central universe, which was made directly by the thought of the universal Father and the word of the eternal Son. Havona is an existential, perfect, and replete universe, surrounding the home of the eternal deities, the center of all things. The creations of the seven superuniverses are finite, evolutionary, and consistently progressive.
Okay, so before we get into some of the bigger details, just notice the very last thing. So it's like, okay, if you have some idea of evolution, you know, your first thought might be, well, what about, you know, retrogression? In contrast to progression. No, it's consistently progressive. Why is, when you're talking about evolution in this general sense, why is it consistently progressive? Why don't we appreciate that?
Because evolution is not consistently progressive. It's sometimes...
In localized settings.
Okay, it's sometimes regressive.
Right, it's something retrogressive. Right, see, that's the thing. Right, it is. But why is it here saying it's consistently progressive? Because in this generalized context, it can't, right? Because it is the supreme. There's no backward, not even one nanometer, you know, in the movement of the supreme. Absolutely, if you will, if you allow me to do that. I mean, forward it goes. Not one shred of retrogression in the total finite evolution, okay? And obviously, as you go down in scale from the total finite to subsets of the finite, you will cross some boundary, okay? But certainly, you're going to have to get below the constellation level in scale before there's going to be any possibility of something that you might call localized retrogression. You know, and even very locally, they're all through the book, they'll point out, now you might think this calamity, like what Adam and Eve did, say, okay, that must have produced a massive retrogression on a universal scale on the whole planet. No, many things could care less about that. They just steadily go forward. That gives you a little bit of a better sense, too, about why things individuate as you go down. So that tails can't wag dogs. You know, as you get down to small scales, some misguided individual or group of individuals may, you know, get themselves, you know, turned around 180 degrees, but they're not going to drag the whole universe with them. Okay. Even though they have an absolute dimension of their personality and a free will attached to that, you know, they're disconnected. You'll get some shear, and there may be lots of, you know, gnashing of teeth along that shear plane as they go backwards and the rest of the universe goes forward. But, the rest of the universe is going to go forward. Okay, so that element. Okay, but the contrast between existential, perfect, replete, and finite, evolutionary, and consistently progressive, they're setting up this contrast between the central universe and outside the central universe. And notice in the first sentence there, so when they say the only creation that is perfectly settled is Avona, and then parenthetically they say the central universe. Okay, is that because those are synonyms, Avona and the central universe? You know, that's maybe what a parenthetical means, that it's a synonym. You got to figure it out. It's like, no, I know they aren't. Havona is just the seven circuits. Then there's the whole central universe. See, so what they're saying is, you know, technically the whole central universe, not just Havona, okay, is perfectly settled. And it is the only thing that the Father and the Son directly created. Okay, and it's just that statement. Okay, pretty revolutionary. To circumscribe God the Father like that. Okay. Now, if you want to be more precise, and you notice they didn't say the universal Father and the eternal Son. They said the thought of the universal Father and the word of the eternal Son. If you want to be more precise about a proper designation for those two persons doing this creating the central universe, you'd call the first source and center, the universal creator. He's not really doing it as the universal Father. He's doing it as the first source and center, or the, you know, the that first person, let's say it that way, is doing it as the universal creator, that he's participating in creating the central universe. And the second source and center is as the co-creator. Now, not the coordinate creator. You use two, remember we've talked about this. There's two different ways to talk about the second person creating. At this mode, before there's a central universe, technically you need to call him the co-creator. He's with the universal creator. Once you have a central universe, second and third persons engage that central universe and acquire experiential deity, mother deity, within that domain. And so subsequent to that, you call the second person the coordinate creator. So like technically, when you have a creator son being made, you know, it's the coordinate creator.
Of course, there never was.
There never was a quote-unquote time, but there was a point in the logical sequence, you know, like they try to point out. It is completely valid to think of there being a logical sequence. There's nothing magical about creation in eternity.
There's no record, though, right?
Right. There's no temporal record because it wasn't something that was in the ticks of time. But in eternity, there's a sequence. When you go to the Isle of Paradise and you're in eternity, there's sequence. You're worshiping now, now you're not worshiping. It's not like everything is all the same, quote-unquote, time. Sequence is greater than time, okay? So when we're talking about this, we use temporal verbiage just for ease, but we're talking about something that is valid. It's not just a crutch for us.
Okay. Would you ever use co, because when they were co way back, as you say, in the first sequence, that was the only time they ever were.
You would use it right here, okay? Here. Yeah, I mean, that's my point. If you're going to be technical about who is participating in creating the central universe, it's not the quote-unquote coordinate creator that's doing it. It's not the eternal mother son that's doing it. The eternal mother son is the coordinate creator. There's no mother, because that experiential deity, that mother deity, is acquired in the central universe. There's no central universe yet. See, you can't, you don't have an eternal mother son yet. This is pre-eternal mother son. This is when you just have the existential, the purely existential eternal son. Okay? And so that's why you look in the book, and sure enough, one time they give you that proper designation, the coordinate creator with capital C, you know, and one time they give you the proper designation of the capital C co-creator. So you have those two terms. They don't want you to have to coin it, because they're afraid you might, you know, get a little off in your coinage, they'll give it to you somewhere in the book so that you know what to properly call, you know, that person in that situation. You know to call him the universal creator here, for instance, because they give you that proper designation. That's what you're expected to call him here. Okay, but you see, it's an existential, perfect, and replete universe. Like I said, the two beings that are creating it are purely existential. So obviously all it can be foundationally, as they created it, is existential. The central universe, you know, has an purely existential foundation because two purely existential beings created it. But subsequently, there is an experiential aspect to the central universe that is added on top of that existential foundation. You know, it's not a changeless place, or it'd be pretty hard to ascend through it. You know, there's a wake behind you as you go through it, right? You're changing. The central universe is never going to be the same again once you go through, or once any, you know, everything changes. So that first one, see, they're just trying to get you in that mode where you're thinking very precisely about when you come to recognize that And now even after the central universe, the Father remains purely existential. The Father has no experiential deity aspect to him at all. He is the one pure existential fact. And so that means you can't put him into an experiential setting. He has to stay in an existential setting. Okay, so let's see what that gives me. Oh, you got something?
I got a question. Okay. You know, when it says a thought.
Yeah, okay.
Is that kind of in a way, like, and it seems like they're comparing it versus, you know, this last sentence where it's the evolutionary. Is that like a fiat? In other words, boom, it just happened? Is that what they, as opposed to what they're about to explain, where evolution is something different?
No, right. I mean, it certainly matches that, that it's, you know, you're thinking of a fiat creation. So I think it and it is, says the Father. Right? Then, of course, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to mention that. I forgot. You know, appreciate, too, the obvious thought, word. Now, instead of saying deed, like we tend to do biblically, you know, we have the thought God and the word God and the God of action. The other thing that's coming into existence simultaneously with the central universe being created is the third person. When you're thinking of it in that mode, when you're thinking of it from an individuality viewpoint mode, you have a first person, a second person, and a third person. You know, and so the third person comes into existence simultaneously with the central universe. You know, in that individuality viewpoint mode, in that,
which is
in that sequence.
Last week we were talking about, you know, it took a million years to make, you know, the architectural spheres or things like that. And, I was imagining in my mind the actual making of them and things like that. And now you're looking at a billion perfect spheres plus the...
A number of beings that can't even be counted, you know, and from our perspective, it's so
just
huge.
Just came into being. They weren't built. In other words, the planets weren't, or the...
Right, it was just thought. Okay. Yeah, and I mean, an example of that process downstepped is, you know, take one of the power beings, you know, like one of the supreme power centers. They have an extended presence. They're a vast being, and they form a thought in their mind. And, you know, they have a mind. There's mindal energy. They put a shape in that mind energy system. That thought form immediately manifests within the energy of their body. Okay, so it goes from mind energy to, you know, sort of quasi-material energy in their body, and is laid down in some way, you know. They think an arrangement of automatons, and it is. Okay. They can, remember that we talked about that, they could do that ad nauseum by fiat, but they don't. They put themselves in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity and evolution. And so they only do that when the hour has come, you know. Just like all these beings that put themselves in cooperative subordination, doesn't matter if it's a supreme power center or Jesus. You know, they're watching the evolution of the Supreme. And the Supreme allows it now. Now, it's not like you can't do it at another time, but if you do it, you're in rebellion. You know, that's, you know, a better way to think about what rebellion is thinking that you are don't have to be in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, downstepped as the Supreme. You know, the evolution of the Supreme is boss, and you can't do something out of sync with that. So all of these father-like fiat acts that any being might do, it's fine as long as they have a broad enough perspective that they can see the big picture and put it properly in place. It strikes steps with that evolutionary picture. Otherwise, it's going to be rebellion. Okay. And to just appreciate a creator son, they don't automatically do things right. They have to see and choose. to do it right. It doesn't just happen that they pick the right point in time. You know, they analyze it, you know, and plumb the depths of insight relative to it and stick it right there at that particular point in time. Okay. All right, so let's get some more here.
I'm sorry, but could I say that the Supreme then adjusts to whatever your best decision was at the time?
Right, the Supreme Mind, it always, you know, can adjust any finite set of facts to keep it consistently progressive. Because all these things are finite, so a supreme mind can adjust to any finite set of circumstances. So that's, you know, technically how it can keep going forward, no matter what happens with the deck chairs, even if they're on the Titanic. Okay, he, she, it can keep it going forward.
The physical systems of time and space are all evolutionary in origin. They are not even physically stabilized until they are swung into the settled circuits of their super universes. Neither is a local universe settled in light and life until its physical possibilities of expansion and development have been exhausted, and until the spiritual status of all its inhabited worlds has been forever settled and stabilized.
Okay, so the first half there is what we were just reading about. Remember, they even kind of gave us a precise length of time, you know, to really get that physically stabilized and swung into the settled circuits thing. You know, that's that billion years that the power beings, you know, once everything was kind of down in the plane of the Milky Way, they got it. It took them a billion years to sort of get it basically, you know, roughed into the super universe physical system. But going forward, notice what they stress, that there's this very tight linkage between the subsequent physical evolution of things and the personal evolution, if you will, or the spiritual evolution and the mind evolution that goes between them. That in order to get a universe settled in light and life, a local universe settled in light and life relative to, you know, the personalities that you first would think of, them all being finally solidly consecrated to the universal harmony, all of the physical things have to be in place too. So when a local universe is settled in light and life, it doesn't have supernovas going off in it and stuff like that. Okay? But before that, yeah, a local universe could have a supernova in it. You know, and all the power beings are going to have to deal with that, you know, where neighboring systems that, you know, that are inhabited, they, you know, that they have to be shielded from that, and all these sorts of issues. So, that, you know, it's a very dynamic, complicated problem. But it's all brought together. And that's because, again, everything is in, all this whole process is in cooperative subordination to the Supreme, which is not just the Mother, it's also the Almighty. It's not just the personal purposive, it's also the power pattern. And there has to be a synthesis, a power personality synthesis. So think about that, you know, the job of bringing the whole, all of the atoms of a local universe into light and life too.
A-T-O-M-S or
A-D-A-M? A-T-O-M-S, yeah. And the A-D-A-M-S's too, but... Yes, but the eight, yeah, the molecules, all the dirt clods have to, you know, conform. Okay.
the grand universe is settled in light and life. Mm-hmm. Does that then follow the same pattern as Havona at that point?
Right,
in its perfection?
Right. Basically, it just means the central universe expanded out.
Okay.
Yeah, and everything is locked as an eternal object. Yeah. Okay. You know, and I've pointed out, maybe just you know, there's the absonite geometry of the central universe extends outward then too to encompass the whole master universe. You know. Whatever geometry is really there, that we're only given the finite shadow of it, you know. They're saying the finite shadow cast by that absonite geometry, you know, is a plane with seven circuits and, you know, strings of pearls. But that's just the shadow. That's not what it really looks like, because what it really looks like is beyond your ability to consciousize. But that's finitely what it looks like.
So are you saying there would no longer be any differential between the different super universes?
There's not going to be a differential like now. I can't answer the question of exactly what. The revelators speculate about that. I mean, obviously, just because the seven super universes get settled in light and life, it doesn't mean the seven master spirits go away. And the seven master spirits are eternally distinct. They don't blend together because of the grand universe being settled in light and life. You know, their distinction transcends it. I mean, that's why there's seven segments in each of the outer space levels, because they're not just supreme personality activity. They're, I have also ultimate personality activity, which, is imposed upon. So there will still be a sevenfold individuation of spirit unity. It will just be encompassed, in some way.
Being created.
Yeah. Right, but not being created. See, that's the other thing. Once there'll be no more creation. It'll be eventuation after that. Remember, creation is technically a finite word. Yeah. It's just like there won't be any evolution anymore either.
Right. No families.
There will still be sequence. There'll still be all these things that just won't be, you can't use the finite words for them anymore.
No growth.
There won't be finite growth anymore. There will be absentite growth. There won't be finite truth, beauty, and goodness anymore. There'll be something transcendent of that. I mean, remember they tell you that point blank one time. It's like, now technically, truth, beauty, and goodness, that gets transcended. It's like, what? It's like, well, got to remember, those are technically, the only thing you can imagine related to those three words is finite. And that threefold differential that you're calling truth, beauty, goodness in the finite, that gets transcended. There'll be a higher differential. There'll be absentite analogs to all that stuff. We're going to leave all that stuff behind. So it's very hard to wrap your mind around.
Now, at this point, of course, in order to go from one super universe to the other, you have to go from
Right. And right.
But after, like,
right.
That,
they'll, obviously,
you'll be able to go direct.
Right. It'll be
distinction.
Right.
It won't be inhibited as it is now.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, those divisions will be transcended. I mean, right now, the reason you can't go is because finite beings can't get over that wall. It's basically sort of an absentite wall, see, that's blocking. But once you get up above that, then you can go over. But it doesn't mean the wall won't be there anymore. It's just it'll be a very low wall, from that higher perspective, and you just have to step over it. But there'll still be a divide between the two. Okay. All right, let's get some more here.
Except in the central universe, perfection is a progressive attainment. In the central creation, we have a pattern of perfection, but all other realms must attain that perfection by the methods established for the advancement of those particular worlds or universes. And an almost infinite variety characterizes the plans of the Creator Sons for organizing, evolving, disciplining, and settling their respective local universes.
Okay, so we talked about that a little bit. When you say there's 700,000 local universes and 700,000, distinct personalities, absolutely unique personalities of the 700,000 Creator Sons. And creative mother spirits that go with those 700,000 local universes. Like they're saying, it's from our perspective, it's effectively infinite. This almost infinite variety. So, what would some of those be? We'll get to that a little bit in a subsequent paper here, but just remind yourself. I mean, it's just kind of screaming at you when you read that last list. They purposely say organizing, evolving, disciplining. what's a simple little example of that contrast? I mean, since our Creator Son, more like the Eternal Son, a mercy-dominated Creator Son, one of the differences that is immediately in play when it's when mercy leads rather than love, it's like, well, wouldn't love be even, well, you got to remember, though, the love of the Father is just the other side of a coin. The other side of love is law. You know, to get the love of the Father directly instead of downstep through mercy, downstep through the Son, if you apply love directly, you get law applied directly at the same time. They're inseparable. You know, so, you know, we have a simple example of what that looks like. When Michael is going to do his seventh pistole, and he is, after all, in his seventh pistole, consecrating his will to the will of the Universal Father, as opposed to the other six wills, and so it's very appropriate that while he is doing that, Emmanuel is in charge, and Emmanuel is the expression of the Ancients of Days, you know, as a union of days, the Ancients of Days, the Super Fathers, the capital J Judges, right? You know, and so what does Emmanuel tell Michael? In this interim of your incarnation, I hold the orders of the Ancients of Days, which unqualifiedly mandate the instantaneous and automatic extinction of any being guilty of rebellion or presuming to instigate insurrection in the universe of Nebadon while you are absent on this bestowal. Okay. So, if you went to a local universe where that Creator Son is, you know, is in a very sort of direct mode of expressing the Father like that, that's the way his universe, you know, would roll. I mean, even the presumption of instigating insurrection is automatic extinction. Okay. See, now, I'm bringing this out specifically because that should start to feel a little prickly, okay? That should start to not feel warm, as warm and fuzzy as you've always wanted God to be, especially God the Father. See, so this is part of the point. You know, be careful what you ask for. If you ask for the pure love of the Father, I don't want anything in between. Okay, be careful what you ask for, okay? Because there's no difference between love and law in the eyes of the Father, right? You know, so you need it, you have a difficult, it's like, well, let's see, would I have liked if Michael had done what he could have done and done that father-like thing with the rebellion? Or do I like it playing out for 200,000 years with some mercy? I don't know, a six of one, half a dozen of another. Okay, but anyway, just, you know, not to dwell on that, the negative of that, but just, you know, that's what, discipline, that's what they mean. You know, think about what it might be like if you have a really father-dominated creator-son in the first super universe, which is also a direct expression with the first master spirit of the Father's will. You know, unlike here, where the whole super universe isn't, you know, the Father's will. It's
not a lot
So, you know, I mean, it ought to be kind of not so amazing that Grand Fanda came from the first super universe. You just clear the path, okay? Nothing to slow him down, because anything that might slow you down, you know, all those rebellion things that retards, you know, the process. So, you know, he can take a beeline through that. Because the snowplow just clears all the garbage out of the way.
Yeah. I've missed that love and law thing. If law is the backside of love, what is the backside of mercy?
Well, see, I mean, when once you downstep, you don't. It isn't like that. See, so it's a, you know, it's like you have the first source and center, and then you bifurcate into the eternal sun and the Isle of Paradise. The Isle of Paradise is not the flip side of the eternal sun. Those are absolutely separate facts. Okay. So, you know, it's just, that's what I'm saying. You understand, you know, what it's, when you're talking about something that's prior to any separation, like prior to separation between spirit and spirit substance and matter, that means if the Father does something, you know, energy-like, substance-like, it'll be, you know, spirit on one side and energy on the other. Or, you know, technically, it's like I was talking about before. You take all the Father fragments; those are pure spirit. You flip them around, and you have the four shards of space.
And that's law.
Well, I mean, yes and no.
I mean,
yeah, but it's just, you know, it's what we think is the complete opposite and absolutely separated. The two things that couldn't be farther apart is the pure spirit of a Father fragment and something that's not even energy yet, let alone purposed energy power. I mean, how could it seems like is the most farthest removed from spirit. That's because you're looking at it where it's observable, where spirit is here and force is here, and there's this vast gap. But if you look at the relation where you can't see with insight, you know, the back door, see, they're actually touching. You know, and on the backside, and we're just seeing the distance. You know, we're thinking there's this vast distance. You got to go all the way around the ellipse.
Isn't it mercy's applied law or something like that?
Mercy is applied love. Justice is applied law. Right? Right. See, so the contrast is justice and mercy, but it's not two sides of one coin anymore. See, they're separate. One is very personal, and one is purely non-personal. See, that's very separate.
Yeah, so what you read about Emmanuel was, you know, that's on a relative term, because obviously, you know, there were human beings on Earth at the time or in other places that, you know, I don't know if rebellion is the right word, but, you know, committed iniquity or things like that that weren't just totally annihilated, because, but it's a relative thing. He's more talking about if something like what we're going through now and, you know,
sure. I mean, you know, basically,
if
obviously,
happen, you know, on that kind of
basically, he's talking about planetary princes and system sovereigns, you know, or maybe Adam and Eve. But, you know, don't be so quick to presume. I mean, there may be some worlds where humans are in greater play than here.
But they'd have to know what they're doing.
Right.
I mean, it's not like right. Innocent.
If Eleonora had flipped, okay. Yeah, you know, if someone like that, see, where, you know, a human is basically taking the role of the Adam or the Eve on the planet, you know, and if they just decided, well, screw this, maybe, you know, the divine executioners also execute mortal beings sometimes.
Oh.
They don't just execute spiritual beings. You know, that's why those divine executioners are able to engage matter. You know, and if it's a really big job, they can order they have control over the master physical controllers. You know, they could order them, well, I don't know, why don't you just make the whole solar system go away? I mean, you know, that's why I said you don't know what the heck is between the lines of that one statement. You know, where the revelators say there's sometimes they do things that are really hard to understand. Okay, and you're going, whoa, okay, so this is a very high being who's seen a lot of stuff, but lived for billions of years or whatever, and they're thinking that sometimes what those divine executioners do is, it's like, do you really have permission to do that? Is that okay?
Well, in that case, I vote for number two. I'm glad that mercy-dominated universe rather than a law.
I've tried to point this out. I mean, that's part of the rugged truths of the revelation. I mean, have you not read what it says about divine executioners? Have you not read that the angels of nation life are the angels of the trumpets? You know who the angels of the trumpets are. Have you not read that it says that they are real? You know, these sorts of things. Be careful what you ask for. I mean, the action of fiat is seldom gentle. So, you know, that's part of what we're talking about here. Come to like evolution. Maybe evolution isn't as bad as you thought. The cushion that is evolution, that cushions you from the existential, where it just is. Okay? You want to have, in general, you want to have a cushion between you and the purely existential. You know, because when the existential enters in, it's like when a Most High Observer becomes a Most High Regent and three personalized adjusters are immediately standing there. Okay, that means things are going to get ugly. People are going to die. Okay? I mean, you know, we're talking some sort of fiat thing is about to happen. Let's skip all that time crap, okay, and cut to the chase. That's what's going on there. Okay? Eternity just stepped in, and it doesn't care about time. It doesn't know of time. You're going to skip all the cushioning of time. Okay? All right. Okay, so that's a simple example, that contrast between the Father and the Son. There's a reason why the Father is purely existential, purely God as transcendence, not inside. In general, too prickly for the inside. Needs to stay outside, okay? You gotta let things slowly take their course, and he would prevent that. He would transcend all of that, and right. Okay, so let's now we got a great big paragraph you see here.
With the exception of the deity presence of the Father, every local universe is, in a certain sense, a duplication of the administrative organization of the central or pattern creation. Although the universal Father is personally present in the residential universe, he does not indwell the minds of the beings originating in that universe as he does literally dwell with the souls of the mortals of time and space. There seems to be an all-wise compensation in the adjustment and regulation of the spiritual affairs of the far-flung creation. In the central universe, the Father is personally present as such, but absent in the minds of the children of that perfect creation. In the universes of space, the Father is absent in person, being represented by his sovereign sons, while he is intimately present in the minds of his mortal children, being spiritually represented by the pre-personal presence of the mystery monitors that reside in the minds of these will creatures.
Okay, so one step at a time here. So notice the interesting way they're starting to transition to a little bit bigger picture. Something you don't see very often, the way they just described the adjusters in that first sentence. With the exception of the lowercase d, deity, presence of the Father. Okay, why that reference? Well, you know, once you get into total deity and you recognize more of the details of what's going on, a thought adjuster is literally a fragment of a particular facet of deity. That facet that's called the infinite upholder, one of the six facets of deity that are part of the Father, the infinite upholder. So you take, you fragment that capital D deity, and you could describe it. So capital D is sort of a top-down point of view, the unity viewpoint. You know, you make the D lowercase d when they want to use that word in a bottom-up viewpoint. Okay, so as a fragment of capital D deity, you can talk about them as being this localized lowercase d deity presence. Okay, and I mean, just to tie in at the very end, notice now you're not going to experience it as a deity presence, you know, in any sort of direct way, even lowercase d, really. They don't call them pure lowercase d deity, for instance. They call them pure spirit, what you experience. So you notice they, being spiritually represented, okay, by the... You know, so that's it's going to be come off that unity, that fundamental quality of deity is unity. You know, and especially when you're thinking in this fragmented sense, it's going to come off as the unity substance, spirit. Okay, so there'll be this spiritual representation, with the thought adjusters. So there's that little interesting tweak, which is obviously getting a little bit more abstract and complicated to think about. Okay, and then now it's starting to get a little more challenging, though, too. They're going to talk about it more directly in a little bit here, but they're breaking it in already. Get you to come to terms with the fact that the Father is not personally present here. Now, there is a place where he is personally present. But there's even a qualification to that. Now, the only place that he's in the full sense as the first infinite personality, there's only one place where he is present as such, as the infinite personality, and that's at the center of the upper surface of the Isle of Paradise, where his feet are, as the infinite Father, or technically the deities you might call the Father Infinite. Okay, but like we were saying last week, reminding ourselves last week, that can't be directly exposed to anything. So that's encased in the sun, and that's encased in the spirit, and the whole those are existential too. So those existential facts can't be directly exposed either to the experiential domain. So that has to be encased in the functioning of the Paradise Trinity.
Enshrouded.
Yeah, enshrouded, encased. You know, whatever word you want to use. You know. I mean, I picked stronger or looser word, just, you know, I mean, I picked encased just because, you know, like we were saying, you need an impermeable barrier. You can't let the existential directly touch the experiential domain, or it'll usurp it. So the Trinity, like they tell you, the Trinity is the only facet of deity that directly touches reality, okay, as a triunity, the whole of it. Other parts of deity touch parts of it, you know, in circumscribed ways. But there's only one facet that is allowed to touch the whole triunity, you know, like matter, mind, and spirit together is the way we think about that. And that's the Paradise Trinity. It has to be a non-personal fact so it doesn't get, you know, usurped. Yeah.
So when we're on Paradise and we're mm-hmm. trying to recognize first the
yep.
infinite mm-hmm.
The infinite spirit, eternal son, the universal father. Yep.
We can't see them directly. We can only see them through insight.
Well, okay. That's related to what I was just going to get at. Okay.
If what you're saying.
Remember, the first thing they tell you, you have to be able to penetrate the Paradise Trinity to get to the third person. You know, they literally describe it that way. See, because of what I'm saying, you got to be able to see through and engage. But even there, all you're actually engaging, all you're able to engage, is what is literally personally present in Havona. See, so let's go back to that and kind of appreciate what's technically going on. Because remember, as you're ascending through Havona, that you're doing this thing where you're temporarily going to paradise. Okay, what is it that you're experiencing? What is personally present in Havona? Or in the central universe, let's say it that way. It's not the Father Infinite. It's the Father Absolute. And even then, it's not the fullness of that. I mean, technically, if you want to think about it in individuality terms, you know, the universal Father being personally present. It's the universal Father in the sevenfold. Not in the, you know, not raw. Not direct, but in the sevenfold. You know, to remind yourself that, you know, that literally when you're looking at the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart here, for instance, and you're looking at the sevenfold creators, when you say the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the conjoint actor there, there's, you know, a little asterisk next to each of those that you got to remind yourself. That's the universal Father in the sevenfold. The eternal Son in the sevenfold. The contrary actor in the sevenfold. Those aren't the infinite facts directly. So another thing that comes into existence when the central universe is created is the sevenfold, that facet of deity. Both the spirit and the sevenfold come into existence. Yeah, there's a question that's coming in.
Pam made a comment. Mm-hmm. She said, I think that what they are saying is self-explanatory. Since the Father is present in person, he is present here in our minds. As it says, we are compensated, so there is never a deficit.
Right, there's never, but there is a personal deficit. Like they said, the adjuster is not the Father personally, a personal representation. It's a spiritual representation. And again, this is part of warning. You're about to be told something that you probably don't want to be told. That even with an adjuster, the Father is not personally present. Okay? He's just spiritually present. It's a personal ministry. There's a person behind it. But he is not, he cannot be personally present out in this room or in your mind, or the room will cease to exist. You will cease to exist. God is transcendence. And that's when you're talking about Percy, God, you know, personalized deity, God is transcendence. And he's not personally present in the presence of the adjuster. We can't even remotely handle the spiritual, let alone the personal yet. Okay, so.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Can I just say something?
Yep.
Well, I think of it as we've got to remember that the adjuster's not personalized yet. So it's an unpersonalized.
Right, pre-personal, right. See, so it obviously can be a personal presence.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like they don't tell you that almost every time they talk about them, you know, as a pre-personal fact, okay? Don't fuzz that. You got to have the courage to separate yourself from the personal presence of the Father. There's benefits to that are not immediately obvious, that are part of the evolutionary idea. Okay? The evolutionary idea is the Father's idea, the thought God. Okay? This isn't something that's an affront to the Father. It's his idea. That the very best thing for you is for him to not be personally present. So accept that, even if you can't understand it. It would be worse for him to be personally present. Just say that to yourself. Okay, I don't know why, but I've actually pointed out, I mean, there's something trivially obvious about why. If he was personally present, you wouldn't be. Do you want to be or not? he has to be separate or you can't be. Because he's an infinite person. How much of this room would he fill? Okay, would there be any room left for you? No. He doesn't go around you. Okay? He can't fit inside. Okay? All right, so you know, what you have is the universal Father in the sevenfold, you know, an absolute person, not an infinite personal expression, that is personally present there in Havona. And they're giving you this little contrast. Again, they're trying to gently get you to think, boy, I wish I lived in Havona where I could be where the Father was personally present in the room instead of here. It's like, yeah, but if you were there as a Havona native, you wouldn't have a thought adjuster. You wouldn't have the Father present within you. Got to pick. You can't have both. Right? You know, all the perfect persons are already created, and just notice that all those perfect persons don't have thought adjusters. As an existential fact, now we all know that Father fragments come in when they engage the experiential. But
I'm thinking, whenever a person experiences grief, whatever that grief is, it's they're feeling the separation
mm-hmm.
from God.
Yeah,
and when that. But it's in that separation that that's the capacity where we can live. If there wasn't that separation.
But the thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to help us with grief, for instance. That's one of the things that you're not maybe immediately recognizing here. If you'll allow for God the Father to be separate, it allows for God. There is a God as immanence. What you're looking for is not the Father. You're looking for that which is immanent, God the Mother. There is God there present to give you strength in that time of difficulty. And you think, well, isn't that just, a difference in name only? But the thing is, to have a relationship with God the Mother and feel not feel the separation when these difficult times come, you have to put your mind in a totally different state than it is when the Father initiated you and gave you that little embryonic relationship to Him. And there is a very important side benefit to that fact. If you have a mind that doesn't despair in the midst of death, say, that's a mind that can have a stable civilization and doesn't mobilize a super universe to send you an emergency revelation because you're about to go over a cliff. That mind that is strong and secure in the face of death also has an advancing civilization and doesn't have all this prickly environment that we're constantly having to deal with. We've begun to take charge of the high seas. See, that's what they're trying to get at. And step one is allowing a place for what you need. If you insist upon absolutely holding the Father present so that nothing else can intervene, then we're going to go over the cliff. It will lead to the fall of civilization because that merely spiritual fact is not going to help you with government and economics and science. You need more than spiritual. You need mind. So this is step one, this very difficult step of weaning yourself off of nothing but the Father. So this is kind of the other hand of the official step one here, where they're trying to do that. So they're going to separate. There is a place where He can be present. And even think about how He would be present in the central universe. It can only be in that foundation that's actually existential. He wouldn't actually be on what's been added onto that because that's experiential. So even His presence in there is just as the initiator, as the foundation. It's not sort of at eye level. It's under your feet there, His presence. Okay, because you aren't just going to be existing in Havona, you're going to be experiencing. And that's what the Father is outside of, those experiences. Okay, all right, so there's that. Now they add in a little bit more.
On the headquarters of a local universe, there reside all those creator and creative personalities who represent self-contained authority and administrative autonomy, except for the personal presence of the Universal Father. In the local universe, there are to be found something of everyone and somewhat of almost every class of intelligent beings existing in the central universe, except the Universal Father. Although the Universal Father is not personally present in a local universe, He is personally represented by its Creator Son, sometime Vicegerent of God, and subsequently Supreme and Sovereign Ruler in His own right.
Okay, so take that last part. You could kind of see it, but they literally stated here, the contrast. So on the one hand, you have spiritually represented by the pre-personal presence of the Mystery Monitors, so spiritually represented, but personally represented by a creator son. Okay, and then the reference, you know, the creator son starts out, free master son, starts out as a vicegerent of the universal father because he is the personal representative, see, of the universal father. But, you know, eventually you have a master son who's a sovereign in his own right. But to get to that, he's got to go beyond the father. He's got to add something to what the father gave him to start with. He has to add supreme deity in order to have sovereignty in an experiential domain. You know, so that master son possesses something that the father will never possess. Experiential deity. He's gone above the father. See, the first shall be last. That's all, you know, he's the first source and center, but in order for everything else, when all is said and done, he's last. He has to humble himself underneath everything so that everything can have a place to be. You know, that's what I was telling you. See, think about it, even where he's personally present in the central universe, it's underneath everything else. Wholly subservient to it all. Not poking himself into it, letting it be its own fact. Okay? Cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. You know, and in that subordination, no one is down deeper, is more subordinated than he who was first and then has to be last.
By choice.
Right. So that we can be he is last in all things.
Just quickly, isn't that, don't you just see that pattern when you see how the Cahil Gibran said, your children are not your children, they come through you, they're not, they're of you, but they don't belong to you, they're the arrow, you are the bow, and you can see that pattern, and you want your children to have more, you know, to grow beyond you.
Right, right. It's the pattern, right. Yeah. Anyone who's with any insight has recognized this in little shades, you know, over the millennia. Okay, you know, but you've noticed, I mean, this little paragraph, and they state it directly twice. Accept the personal presence of the Universal Father. You know, and then they repeat it. Accept the Universal Father. You know, here's where they're finally trying to drive it home. The Father is not, it's not just on Salvington. You know, the first one is saying, well, it was just on the headquarters of the local university. They're saying, but maybe he's out. The next sentence says, in the local universe. They know what you're thinking. They know you're trying to find a place for him to still be so that you don't have to change the way you've always thought. No, in the local universe in total. He's not present. Okay.
Are the other three parts of deity, two parts present?
So, you know, but they say he's personally represented by a creator son.
Right.
Okay, and what kind of deity is a creator son that's personalized so that you can call him God? You have son type deity as the foundation. Because after all, they're called a creator son. So that must be the foundation. And then you have father deity added to that, personalized. But the very fact, see, that they call them creator sons is just, I mean, even if they favor the father, see, that's telling you, okay, they're always son first. Okay, so this personal representation is always in a vicegerent sense. See? Yeah, it's never going to be as maybe as direct as you might hope, but it's wholly adequate. Obviously, it's, you know, you're never going to be wanting for father engagement. But like we've said, I mean, be thankful that there's some son attached to that father locally instead of having to be exposed to the super fathers, you know, without a buffer between you, the capital J judges and their executioners. It's nice to have a little of a time buffer between me, you know, them and me. So I can, you know, get through my thick skull and get going and don't have to face the exterminators immediately. All right. So, you know, so see, that's, you know, I basically, you know, took away a lot of the fire of that paragraph by, you know, in the previous one. But see, you know, they're just stressing it. You know, this is what they want you to come to terms with. You live in a universe where the Father's not personally present. So you got to understand everything with that starting point. That's your initial assumption for achieving a new understanding of things. Take the personal presence of the Father out of the picture and then figure out what's there. There's no holes left when you do that, because it's actually completely filled with things that you haven't noticed because you've, you know, enshrouded them all in the imagination that the Father was personally present and doing everything. Who's actually doing things, and why, and how, and how do I actually fit into that? You know, no wonder my life is not working. I've been trying to live my life as if everything was a fiat fact of the Father. Nothing is a fiat fact of the Father. He's not here. There's an evolutionary idea that you're immersed in. And if you want to have success in life, or relationships, or anything, you have to strike step with that, not the delusion of the fiat presence of the Father. He's not going to, the fiat presence is not going to fix your relationship. The evolutionary idea is going to fix your relationship. Striking step with deity that's related to that and everything, et cetera. See, so you can see how that's what they're trying to get us to. All right, let's read this next great big paragraph here.
The farther down the scale of life we go, the more difficult it becomes to locate with the eye of faith the invisible Father. The lower creatures, and sometimes even the higher personalities, find it difficult always to envisage the universal Father in his creator sons. And so, pending the time of their spiritual exaltation, when perfection of development will enable them to see God in person, they grow weary in progression, entertain spiritual doubts, stumble into confusion, and thus isolate themselves from the progressive spiritual aims of their time and universe. In this way, they lose the ability to see the Father when beholding the Creator's Son. The surest safeguard for the creature throughout the long struggle to attain the Father, during this time when inherent conditions make such attainment impossible, is tenaciously to hold on to the truth fact of the Father's presence in his sons, literally and figuratively, spiritually and personally. The Father and the sons are one. It is a fact. He who has seen a Creator Son has seen the Father.
Okay, they try to strengthen you at the end there with the Bible. Okay, so now hold on to that strength. Okay, now let's back up, go back to the beginning of the paragraph and think through it a little bit more. Okay, so I pointed out what they did in the previous little paragraph. They started with pushing him off of Salvington. Okay, and then you immediately, they know, but he's probably out and, you know, out and about in general in the local universe. No, they push him out of the whole local universe. Well, then you're thinking, well, yes, but what about the Father's personality circuit? What about this sort of personal linkage to the Father that I have? Okay, see, they know you're thinking that next. So what do they say? They go, well, the farther down the scale of life we go, the more difficult it becomes to locate with the eye of faith. See, they knew you were thinking, it's like, well, what about faith? What about faith? Don't I have my faith still? You can't shove him out of that, can you? Like, well, the farther down the scale of life we go, the more difficult it becomes to locate with the eye of faith the invisible Father. So I'm trying to remind you again. This is a very, very tenuous link to the Father that you have, quote unquote, through faith. In other words, by using the third cosmic intuition and your personality, you can muster some relationship to the two, put them together, and work through that conduit that links you into the personality circuit. But of course, even there, once you get technical about it, that other node in the, you know, if you think of this circuit between the Father and you, this personality circuit, that other node, that other endpoint, is the personality absolute at that other endpoint? No, that's the Son. It's the volitional absolute, not the personality absolute that's there. See, so even there, I'm not going to find exactly, see, I'm not going to find that personal presence I was really hoping for. There, you know, really, you can find a volitional absolute, a volitional presence there sharing your life with you. See, again, because you can't actually be able to reach and touch the, you know, that fact like that, or he'd have a doorway in and he'd usurp everything. Again, there's these definitive walls that are set up, even in that linkage, you know. Yep. So, go ahead.
All of the plan, all the evolutionary plan, the abstinent plan, the ultimate plan, it's all designed. It's all from the first source and center. So, I don't need to keep him in my pocket.
Right.
We're living within him.
Right. Right. We're trying to actually get to, what did he create?
Everything.
You know, he created something to be in relationship to me.
Yeah.
It's going to be everything I ever wanted. It's just not him directly. It's what he made for me. What did he make for me? They're trying to get you to that step. Don't so hold so tightly to the Father that there's no room for anything, including your future. You know, you can't hold him so tightly that you don't have a future. Because there's no past, present, or future, you know, in the Father. You're cutting yourself off from the future. You'll end up regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future if you hold the Father too close.
That's a great saying.
Right? Jesus even, you know, taught us that. See, that's what he was speaking about. You can't hold the you know, you have to allow for time. You can't hold so tightly to the existential, the timeless, that you have no future. You know, it literally, you have that ability to realityize the absence of a future. See, it's only with using that direct gift of the Father that you can exterminate yourself. See? You don't want to hold that too tightly. You want to put that way off in the distance. Don't bring it right up close to you right now and have it judge you. It will not find you infinitely perfect. Okay? Push it off. Allow for a future. Allow for the Father's idea, the evolutionary idea. Yep.
So Donald said, so for all intents, when we pray to the Father, isn't this Michael of Nebadon, since the universal Father cannot directly engage us?
See, and even when you go to the existential endpoint of prayer, is the Father at the existential endpoint of prayer? No, the Eternal Son is. I see. I mean, we could go on. You know, I mean, there's no end to these rugged little things that you can.
Pray to God, it goes where it's supposed to go. But
right.
Of course.
But again, see, just that. You know, it's like no, the Father can't be at the other endpoint of that prayer, because the prayer is self-reminding. That would put him in direct contact with himself, and yourself wouldn't be. I mean, there has to be a separation. You can be in more direct contact with the Son, because the Son only touches spirit. The Son's just the absolute spirit. You know, the third person is the absolute mind, so it can touch mind. And the second person is the absolute spirit, so it can touch spirit. The Father through the aisle you can think of as touching matter, as the universal controller. See, it really isn't the Father. It says the universal controller, non-personal sort of, through the aisle can touch matter. But none of them can touch the triunity. None of them can touch all three, or the universe wouldn't exist. Only the Paradise Trinity can touch all three.
If you take his question and take the word prayer and turn it to worship,
right. Right, so that, see, that linkage to worship, you know, through worship, He's obviously a different sort of a thing. Worship does go to the Father. And then you can kind of think about, exactly how. It must not be as intimate as this linkage. I don't want to go way off on all those details, but see, that's all I'm trying to get at, is what they're trying to get you is allow space for some physics of the universe and stuff. There's all this mechanics that's set up, and to recognize why it is and why this is so beneficial to you that it's set up this way instead of the way you initially want it all to be set up. Okay?
And how beneficial it is to the Father. What would you deny the Father if you held him so close that your creativity was locked in and you couldn't contribute to the Supreme with your creative energy and independence? Because he created us to have a relationship, which means you have to have two creative entities.
And you can't have a true relationship until you have separation. If you want to have a true relationship with the Father, you got to allow him to be separate from you.
So it's really free. It frees you up from all of the hang-ups and the programming that we've been given. It's like, get out of the box. Be whatever it is that... Be creative with your life and with your thinking.
Okay. Did you have something, too, before I go on?
Yes. Pam had a couple comments. She said, Eternal Son is the Word.
Mm-hmm.
So hence, Word... And through our words,
Right, you can just see that relationship between prayer and the word God when you think about it like that. Okay? All right, so what else do we have in here? Okay, so... a lot, yes we do. Okay, so the first thing they're trying to get you to, think a little bit more exacting about the whole faith linkage. Okay, when they say the lower creatures, and sometimes even the higher personalities, give me the poster child, Lucifer. find it difficult always to envisage the universal Father in his creator sons. See, so... Now, they're reminding you, it doesn't matter if a being's high or low, the only way that you can see the Father is through the Son. And it's not a glaring, fact in the Son. It's a very subtle fact in the Son. That's why they're called greater sons, not greater fathers. Okay, it's not a trivial thing to see the Father in the Son. It takes a very refined mind. It takes a lot of discrimination. Think about how much discrimination you have to develop to penetrate through the Trinity, through the Spirit, and through the Son in order to see the Father. Even on the Isle of Paradise, he's the subtlest of facts. They tell you, the moment you land on the Isle, it's trivial to see the Trinity. Just this glaring beacon in your face. You can't even remotely see the Father. Okay? You got to penetrate through that infinite glare to even see the Spirit. Then you got to penetrate through another infinite glare to even see the Son. Then you got to penetrate through another infinite glare to even see finally see the Father. Okay? So if it's that difficult, when you're approaching the infinite fact, how difficult is it going to be down here when he's not literally personally present, and I have to try to see him through the Son, subtly in the Son? Lucifer, Caligastia, etc., couldn't. They have a lot better vision than I do. I mean, they're high spirit beings relative to me. I mean, their spiritual vision is very acute, and they couldn't see the Father? So how likely is it that I can see the Father unless I take delight in cultivating a kind of insight that is very transcendent of anything that Lucifer had as a Lindanen deck? I've got to have something greater than that high of a spirit being in order to be assured that I can... Wait a minute, I think there is, subtly I can see the Father. Yeah.
So for me, you know, obviously it's going to be a long time before we can actually see the Father in Michael.
Right.
But we can have the knowledge that he's there, so that gives us more, you know, the impetus to look.
Yep.
You know, to be constantly, you know, trying to find the Father in Michael in one way. I mean, that's probably, you don't leave the universe till you kind of probably do that, become a spiritual being to some degree, till you found that. I mean, right now, I mean, I can sit here and believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Know it's there, but you know, I really don't, you know, I'm so, what do they call me? I'm such a low.
Right, right.
You know, I really don't know what I'm looking at.
Right, yeah. Right. And along that lines, as long as you said that, I'll put this in now. Notice towards the end there, they say, the surest safeguard for the creature throughout the long struggle to attain the Father, during this time when inherent conditions make such attainment impossible, okay, so there they're speaking, they're about to qualify this. What you're looking for actually is not the fact per se, because that's impossible to see. Is tenaciously to hold on to the truth fact of the Father's presence in his sons. Okay, what you're seeking is the truth, not the fact. You need to be a truth seeker, genuinely, not just giving, you know, lip service to that. You know, you need to genuinely be a truth seeker. You have to know the difference between truth and fact. Okay, and that's nothing that you can remotely do to begin with. It takes great delight in cultivating and vast amounts of effort to get to the point where you can begin to discriminate between truth and fact so that you can actually start to seek it rather than thinking you're seeking truth and actually seeking fact and then never finding truth because you're not heading towards it.
It's not visual, though.
It's not visual, all these things. But, you know, we use those visual words to help us understand it. Now, a truth seeker... okay, so see, that's what they're getting at. What you have to see the Father through the Son, you have to know truth. Okay?
You have to trust him, too.
Yes, well, I was just about to get to that, because notice what it says. It says, is tenaciously to hold on to the truth fact. Okay, so you've got to go beyond knowing the truth. What is it? How do we describe it when you're actually holding on to that truth? Obeying the truth. Again, that, you know, why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Okay? You've got to go beyond just knowing. And the initial way you know truth is the truth that's tied to existential eternity, that truth that's tied to beauty and goodness. But this is the truth fact. You need to go above that initial existential relationship with truth, beauty, and goodness. You have to get to the truth that's tied to fact. In order to have any linkage to the fact of the Father through truth via the Son, they're describing here, this is nothing that's even remotely trivial.
Does the Spirit of Truth help us do this?
Yeah, it will help you, but it's sad to record that for almost everyone on the planet, the Spirit of Truth twiddles its thumbs, okay? The Spirit of Truth functioning is wholly dependent upon you establishing some initial personally chosen consecration to the wholeness of the temple within, to the three cosmic intuitions and the, you know, and the wholeness of that nature. The truth can only function in that wholeness. So for instance, if you're just fixated on the third cosmic intuition, the spiritual insight, you have no wholeness. The Spirit of Truth can't work with you. You have to have just as much relationship to causality as you do to true worship. And don't forget what's in between, duty and the moral level. You have to have that holistic picture because this, you know, when you look on the threefold actuality chart, I mean, you have the first cosmic intuition, second cosmic intuition, third cosmic intuition here, and, you know, with individuality, associativity, unity, matter, mind, spirit. Spirit of Truth, see, is the, okay, that's in the wholeness. if you can encompass the wholeness with personality. See, but the personality can only encompass a triunity. Can't just encompass the one facet or the one aspect, the unity aspect. See, so you need to be this personal living philosophy, something that can be encompassed by personality. And then in that holistic context, the Spirit of Truth can help you. Okay, you know, you're kind of getting off, you know, and you know, they're just trying to get you to the first step here. Just, you know, don't be too daunted by, you know, but just even the first step, just getting this sorted out and appreciating what they're saying. You know, why did Lucifer fall? Why do so many mortals fall? It's because they can't see truth well enough. They don't have enough relationship with truth. They got lots of relationship with fact, but not enough with truth. And then notice the key thing they throw in here, which is very sobering. Okay, so when they say, if I can find it here, where in the heck was it? Let's see. So we're reading in from the beginning there. So pending the time of their spiritual exaltation, when perfection of development will enable them to see God in person, they grow weary in progression, entertain spiritual doubts, stumble into confusion, and thus isolate themselves from the progressive spiritual aims of their time and universe. In this way, they lose their ability to see the Father when beholding the Creator Son. So if you want to be able to see the Father, they're telling you the only way you can do it is through the Creator Son. There's no direct line of sight. Okay? And you have to do it through this truth. And they say, what breaks that? Makes it so that you can, you lose all ability to see the Father, period. You know, no faith, you know, avenue to see anymore. If there's what? If you stumble into confusion, okay? The first sentence of the book says, in the minds of the mortals of Urantia, there exists great confusion. Okay? So what is this saying? In the minds of the mortals of Urantia, there exists almost no ability to see the Father. Okay, this is a rugged truth. Now they're saying, you think you've seen the Father, huh? Well, you're delusional. You are so confused. That turbulence in your mind that is confusion, that makes the mind opaque. You can't see through that to see the Father. That's impossible. Any more than I can see through that wall there. That's what they're telling you. And that's what I'm saying. The evolutionary idea, you know, the very first sentence is telling you this is what this revelation is about. You think that all you need is spirit. No. If you don't have a mind that's consecrated to the universal harmony of God the Mother, that mind is by definition confused. And it is opaque. You can't even do what you think you can do, see the Father. You cannot see the Father. If you think you see something, you're delusional. Okay? And that's probably problematic, because if you think you see the Father, you're probably going to try to follow that. Remember all the many times it says danger when it talks about conversion and mysticism out there? Okay? See, they're trying to remind you this. I mean, by definition, most of what you can see is the fog of confusion of an immature mind. Don't follow that mirage that you see in that confusion, that mirage that you call the Father. Don't follow. They tell you point blank, if you think that you're seeing it, it's better to pretend that you ate something bad, okay, than to follow it. It's even if it literally is the Father, it's better to reject it than to follow, than to have to put into play the possibility of following the falsehoods that are in your confusion. Yeah. So very strong words.
If you study the revelation here, you get a much, in my opinion, you get a much greater depth of understanding of what you're looking for when you're trying to find the Father to begin with.
Yeah.
But I know an awful lot of people, you know, who don't really know that Revelation exists, and, you know, have got wonderful souls, great people, so on and so forth, who if they had the same knowledge would probably be way farther along than I am, or most people I know, in finding the Father, etc. But they don't. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you know, the confusion that they run into is not their fault, so to speak. In other words, it's just mm-hmm. that they, you know, haven't gotten there yet. I mean, it's like, you know what I'm saying? And I feel sorry for them.
Right. Okay, so now we've kind of been playing it kind of heavy. Please. Now remember, there's mercy and there's time. Okay, none of us have to do any of this stuff today. You've got seven mansion worlds ahead of you still. So you have eight worlds in which to get going on this process, you know, in a genuine way. There's nothing to be fearful of or panic about here, or worry about having a minimal genetic foundation you have, because what Adam and Eve did and all these sorts of things, and what do they expect of me? And they don't expect anything of you that you can't do, okay? But you can begin, you know, and it begins with humility. The humility that I'll bet you I probably don't see anything yet. So I want to always be in a mode where I'm beginning. I want every day to be behold, all things are becoming new. Begin every day as if you're just beginning, because technically you are, okay? That's what you don't want to ever think that you've reached any end point. Be humble, be patient, be far-seeing. Let it all be courageous so that all of eternity and infinity can roll out in front of you. Now, and then you're going to slowly start to step your way into it. The reason there's dangers with these things is because of the lack of humility. When people aren't humble and they start to engage things that are dangerous for a self-centered fact, then they are dangerous, okay? But none of this is dangerous if you're humble. You have to recognize that none of it is likely going to be very immediate then either. You can make some of these facts like the adjuster immediate, but you're most likely going to destroy yourself. What do they tell you? If you get close to the adjuster, at best you're going to go off on some fanaticism tangent. At worst, it's just going to rip you apart. You want to be patient and humble relative to facts like the adjuster. Put them off at a distance. Just like you're trying to put the Father off at the infinite distance. Okay, so this is what they're getting at. They're trying to directly get you to recognize that the problem we face is not religious fundamentally. It's not really a spiritual problem. Okay? The word confusion is about mind. The problem is with our minds. And it begins with foundational forms in the mind, like your idea of God. Okay? That's what the fifth epical revelation is trying to work on. It's assuming that you've consecrated your will to the perfect will of God the Father, off there outside of time and space. And you're ready. That's what a child of God should do. That's what a child of God is someone who's done that. Now you're ready to take the next step. You want to start working on that mind so that it isn't just a leap of faith that you're consecrating your will to the perfect will. You can begin to actually clear the fog a little bit and start to see what you're consecrating yourself to. The Father will be less invisible, like they said right there. The more your mind becomes consecrated to the universal harmony, the more visible the Father becomes. If the Father had been visible at all to Lucifer, would he have made the choices he did? No. It's because he could not see one iota of the Father. That's why he did what he did. And that's why all of us will do just what he did if we can't see the Father. We've got to make sure we can see some little faint glimmer of the Father, which means we've got to clear some of the fog. The Father doesn't clear the fog for you. You have to choose to clear the fog. All right, let's read some more.
The personalities of a given universe are settled and dependable. At the start, only in accordance with their degree of kinship to deity. When creature origin departs sufficiently far from the original and divine sources, whether we are dealing with the sons of God or the creatures of ministry belonging to the infinite spirit, there is an increase in the possibility of disharmony, confusion, and sometimes rebellion, sin.
Okay, so we just know that. Let me just bring in, you know, together one other little point there that's basically in the previous paragraph about that that whole bishop of seeing the Father's presence in his sons. Okay, the sons are in charge of this evolutionary idea, and you're trying to see the Father's presence in the midst of that temporal evolutionary phenomenon. A simple way to think about what that means is, can you do like it says up in part four? Can you see that right now, this moment, on this benighted sphere, now is a divine dispensation? If that's not just, you know, wishful thinking on your part, blind belief, but if you see that, then you can see the Father. But if you look at the present moment and all you can see is imperfection, then you can't see the Father. If you can see perfecting this, then you can see the Father. So think about all of the spiritually conscious people on the planet. When they look at the present moment and they write a blog, what do they write about? Do they write about how they can see the Father, or do they write about all the things that are wrong with the present moment? They're telling you they can't see the Father. And they're in danger of following Lucifer. They don't know it, but it's sort of a cry. Help me, I can't see the Father.
Mainly they're writing about cats.
Well, but just, you know, just appreciate that. So, you know, think about how, what, like I've tried to point out, what do we do initially with our spiritual consciousness? We use it as an error and evil detector. And we start creating a big list of all the imperfections. Proof that you can't see the Father. If you have any inclination to make one of those lists of all the things that are imperfect around you or with yourself, or if you have any inclination to listen to people that endlessly spew such lists. Okay, no. They don't see the Father. You're consecrating yourself to that, so you'll never see the Father. Their confusion is your confusion. Their lack of sight of the vision of the Father is your lack of vision of the Father. You don't want any part of such things because it's the antithesis of what you're looking for. Give no place for what's wrong. Can you see that now is a divine dispensation? That the evolutionary idea that made this now, right now, is divine, comes from the Father. Can you see that now is divine? Then you can see the Father. And don't stop until you can see that now is divine. Okay? Tenaciously hold, and once you get there, tenaciously hold on to what you see, no matter what's going on around. Hold on to what you see, what you know, right there, okay?
Can I please say this? Mm-hmm. That you want to see it from the bottom up and from the top down, so that when you're hearing all that's negative, when you look at it and see that it is being discussed, it is in front of us being discussed, and you can see that this is part of the Father's plan and the Supreme's plan, that at least it's coming out of the darkness and it's being discussed. Yes, it's ugly, but when you see it from the top down, you see it as a creative endeavor of us dealing with the issues.
Just know you want to orient yourself top down. Top down has to come first. Okay? If you lead with bottom up, that leads to death. Only top down leads to life. Look for others who approach the universe top down. Okay.
Accepting perfect beings of deity origin, all will creatures in the super universes are of evolutionary nature, beginning in lowly estate and climbing ever upward in reality inward. Even highly spiritual personalities continue to ascend the scale of life by progressive translations from life to life and from sphere to sphere. And in the case of those who entertain the mystery monitors, there is indeed no limit to the possible heights of their spiritual ascent and universe attainment.
So, see, notice we're switching gears here. And look what they did, just exactly what I just said. Accepting beings of capital D, deity origin. Okay, top down now. Okay. See, that's where there's security. You want to be like that. You want to be... you want to be deity origin-like. You want to be divine-like. You want to be top-down-like. Okay? It's not enough to be lowercase, have a fragment of lowercase deity in your mind. I am, therefore, you know, no problem. No. You got to choose to orient yourself top-down. So that they're stressing that. They're bringing it in. And see, you notice they're also accepting, they don't say accepting perfect beings of origin in God or something. I mean, your deity. So again, that's the whole point. When you get top down, we're going to talk about deity. Okay?
The perfection of the creatures of time, when finally achieved, is wholly an acquirement, a bona fide personality possession. While the elements of grace are freely admixed, nevertheless, the creature attainments are the result of individual effort and actual living, personality reaction to the existing environment.
Okay, so wholly an achievement. See, so what you're looking for, one must do something as well as be something. See, and then you go, well, wait a minute, what about that initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit that I'm given by grace and all these sorts of things? You know what? See, they know you're thinking that. So they go, while the elements of grace are freely admixed, nevertheless, see, when all is said and done, even those initial things you're given by grace to start up the process, you have to take personal ownership of those things eventually. Even those things that were initially given by grace have to be fully encompassed within you by choice. So when all is said and done, as you stand on the aisle, everything that's there is wholly an achievement. Okay, even that which was initially grace. You know, and just think about that. Because it's grace, see, it actually isn't yours, technically. It's God's still. You have to take possession of that. You have to establish within you the equivalent of what God is letting you borrow initially. And in our case, you know, it's a creative mother spirit. It's basically, you know, who's loaning us a bunch of things. We have to grow the analog of that within ourselves so that we don't need that anymore. Because eventually I'd like to leave the local universe. I have to unplug myself from her. I can't be borrowing anything from her anymore. See, so all those things that I have by grace from her initially, I have to replace those with what I've personally chosen. You know, and then that's a tricky thing because none of that is fiat. All you can do is choose the favorable conditions. She has to grow those things in you, grow the replacements for what she's letting you borrow. So you have to supply the favorable conditions for her to do that.
This is part of the whole process of evolution.
Yeah, and that's why
experience is the great thing about it.
And that's why it tells you when the whole thing that dominates all the way up to the local universe is the mother, not the father. Remember when they tell you that up there, you know, in the Supreme Papers? This is why, because you've got to grow all these substitutes for the initial grace, and it has to be you that leaves the local universe because she can't. All right, you know, and they love to use bona fide, personality possessions, good faith. You know, it all begins with that faith grasp, okay, and builds from there. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
The fact of animal evolutionary origin does not attach stigma to any personality in the sight of the universe, as that is the exclusive method of producing one of the two basic types of finite intelligent will creatures. When the heights of perfection and eternity are attained, all the more honor to those who began at the bottom and joyfully climbed the ladder of life, round by round, and who, when they do reach the heights of glory, will have gained a personal experience which embodies an actual knowledge of every phase of life from the bottom to the top.
Yeah, like we've pointed out, that's fundamentally what a finaliter is. You know, so if something makes it so that you don't embody everything from the bottom to the top, then you there's another path besides finaliter ahead of you. That's fundamentally what a finaliter is. Just the one little thing there, if it's not obvious, I'll stress it. See, don't beat yourself up. Stop looking at yourself as a blob of imperfection. Okay? The fact of animal evolution or origin does not attach stigma to any personality in the sight of the universe. Okay? There's nothing wrong with your imperfection in time. Yeah, it's wrong in eternity, but I don't think we're there yet. Okay? So there's nothing wrong with it. Don't judge it with an eternity eye, with that relationship to existential deity. That has no place. You're in time. It's an evolutionary idea, not an existential ideal that you should be judging yourself relative to. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, and that's why it's really inappropriate to call it imperfection. It's perfectingness. That's what it is. Okay, and that's why it's not wrong. It's not an absence of something. It's a something that you are not initially noticing. If you can see, like I said, if you can see your perfectingness, that proves that you can see the Father. If all you can see when you look in the mirror is imperfection, then you can't see the Father. If that doesn't feel warm and cozy, that knowing that you can't see the Father, well, do something about it. Okay? Don't languish in futile yearning, as Jesus said.
Okay. In all this is shown the wisdom of the creators. It would be just as easy for the universal Father to make all mortals perfect beings, to impart perfection by his divine word. But that would deprive them of the wonderful experience of the adventure and training associated with a long and gradual inward climb, an experience to be had only by those who are so fortunate as to begin at the very bottom of living existence.
Oh, it all sounds so wonderful. Sunshine and lollipops. And remember, think about it clearly. What they're describing as a wonderful experience, you know, and as being fortunate is pain and suffering. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. This is the kind of radical change that they're demanding of us. You know, in order to see that now is innately divine, you've got to see pain and suffering in a positive mode and not a negative mode. And that is not easy for an animal origin being.
No.
Not even remotely, okay?
I can't get anybody to agree to that.
I mean, what on earth is immediately pleasant about pain and suffering to the flesh? Okay? So in other words, you're going to have to get way up above the flesh in order to see the Father. Yeah? The level of the flesh is the first level of meaning. The level where you can see the Father is the sixth, couple levels up. Don't ever let those things just, you know, be all filled with daisies when they say something like that, okay? That wonderful experience is nothing but prickly to an animal origin creature. This is not going to be easy. It's going to take you a lot of work to convince your animal origin self to not hate pain and suffering, and hence hate the source of that, God. Right? Curse this, you know. I mean, the primitives woke up and just howled at, you know, because another day of pain and suffering sent from the heavens, you know, so they'd howl at the heavens. Right? Even the primitive people knew logically where the pain and suffering must have come from. It must have come from on high, because it didn't. Yeah. That's a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
I just want to say that I do talk to a lot of ranch book readers who feel that their trials and challenges are blessings.
Yeah, sure. So, right. I'm not saying that, you know, that there's... Right. Again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying we're all, you know, at square zero on this. But you know, there's always tomorrow for more pain and suffering. Just because you've made it through 12 days of pain and suffering doesn't mean there isn't a 13th day. You know, it's essential to progressive evolution. It's the differential that powers the progress. It's not, the universe is not a dead battery. If you stick your hand in between two poles, there's a lot of energy between those two poles. It's painful. Okay, we live between the two poles. Okay.
Yeah, that brings us all the way back to the beginning of this paper about progress and how it's always consistent, but
consistently progressive.
You see, in the Lucifer Rebellion, they talk about it as the good will weigh far outweigh.
Right. Yeah. Even in this short period of time. Yeah.
And that cultural level is so hard to see.
All right, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, this stuff is all fine and dandy when it's theoretical, you know, but when it actually is in play, you know, can you live this? Do you have just faith or do you have living faith? You're constantly being tested. Your angels are put here to, you know, every time you say, I have faith, you go, well, let's put it to the test and see if it's dead faith or living faith. No, you know. Be careful. Maybe you don't want to just blurt that out all the time, very, you know, egotistically. Maybe a little humility. Yeah, not the angels.
It's more than faith, though. You've got to remember to put forward the favorable conditions.
Right, but I'm just talking about in that sense. And, of course, that living faith, it's like Terry said, I mean, trust. You have to have trust. You know, before there's the fifth epical revelation, there's the fourth epical revelation, love and service. Before there's the fourth epical revelation, there's the third epical revelation, trust and faith. You can't even do what Jesus was asking you to do if you don't have trust and faith yet. If you haven't done what Machaventa told you to do. You can't love if you don't trust. It's impossible. You're delusional if you think you're loving if you don't trust. I mean, is there still fear? Then you don't trust. I mean, Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, first step, fear not. Replace fear with trust. It's like, well, I don't know if I can even achieve that in this life. Well yeah, see, start with that. And maybe in the first mansion world, you can start on the fourth epical revelation. Okay? But, you know, here we are reading the fifth. It's presuming that you've got all of that in place. There's unshakable trust. There's not a shred of fear. You're going to courageously and independently just tear through all of your ideas of God. Everything that you've held sacred is going to be shredded. And you're going to start all anew. And you're going to clear the fog of your mind as you trust absolutely that nothing of survival value is lost when you bring out the shredder. That's what this is about. These are rugged truths. Okay? This is not 4,000 years ago. 4,000 years ago was trust and faith. 2,000 years ago was love and service. This is now. The divine dispensation of now is built upon 4,000 years that you should have eventuated within you. It should be your beginning. All right, let's read some more here.
In the universes encircling Havona, there are provided only a sufficient number of perfect creatures to meet the need for pattern teacher guides for those who are ascending the evolutionary scale of life. The experiential nature of the evolutionary type of personality is the natural cosmic complement of the ever-perfect natures of the Paradise Havona creatures. In reality, both perfect and perfected creatures are incomplete as regards finite totality. But in the complemental association of the existentially perfect creatures of the Paradise Havona system with the experientially perfected finaliters ascending from the evolutionary universes, both types find release from inherent limitations and thus may jointly attempt to reach the sublime heights of the ultimate of creature status.
Okay, so they're just kind of setting the stage for some final statements here, reminding you that you have perfect on the one hand, perfected on the other. Yeah. Existentially perfect, brought into relationship with experientially perfected. and that there's a super additive consequence that allows you to get to a relationship, full relationship with supremacy. That starts when you're going through Havona and you're just trying to put your perfectingness into relationship with that perfectness. That the super additive consequence of the relationship between your perfectingness and their perfectness is your perfected nature. But now we're moving on to the next notch, you know, and like we've stressed so many times, so you ascend to perfection, you're done. It's like, now what? Now comes phase one of completion, finite completion. So you remember how we've always stressed, there's those are technical words. You ascend to perfection and then you penetrate to completion. So even when a Havona native starts with perfection, they don't have to ascend to it, they still aren't complete. They still have that whole penetration to completion thing to do. Okay. All right, so that's what they're stressing, that you have those two phases. All right, there's some more here.
These creature transactions are the universe repercussions of actions and reactions within the sevenfold deity, wherein the eternal divinity of the Paradise Trinity is conjoined with the evolving divinity of the supreme creators of the time-space universes, in, by, and through the power-actualizing deity of the supreme being.
Okay, so now they're reminding you, and then they'll kind of bring it back around to the creatures in the next paragraph, but what's the pattern here? The pattern is the supreme. And the supreme isn't just plop. There's that deity called the supreme. That's a super additive consequence that comes into existence. Okay, and they're reminding you of those two. That on the one hand, you have the eternal divinity of the Paradise Trinity downwelling as a fact that we call the mother. Okay. And what meets that as an upwelling phenomenon? What is the power personalizing deity of the supreme being? Okay, it's not the supreme. It's not the mother. What's that facet of deity called that's down in the finite?
The Almighty.
The Almighty. Right. The power actualizing deity, i.e. the Almighty. So through the Almighty. See? So they're just reminding you, you have this bi-directional flow. Mother downwelling, Almighty upwelling, the super additive consequence is the supreme. So there's probably going to be parallels of that, you know, downwelling, upwelling phenomenon. And then notice the other thing they threw in. Again, the reminder that I gave you up front. See, now technically all of this is happening in the context of another facet of deity called the sevenfold. And they refer to that facet of deity there, the sevenfold deity. Okay, to get into the details of that is very complicated, but they're reminding that technically you have this deity, and then within this, when you're thinking about creatures doing this, there's a divinity. And even in the bigger sense, notice, so in the context of that deity, they talk about the eternal divinity of the Paradise Trinity, and then the evolving divinity. See, both of them are divinity, not deity. So, like I said, you have the deity thing literally, with the Mother and the Almighty. And then you have a deity likeness, a divinity, that's sort of, you know, within that context. And all of that in the finite is within the context of the sevenfold. This is all, you know, the technical details of this in total deity is very complicated. Okay? And they're giving, you know, reminding you of that for this advanced student here. Okay. So that's why they're, you know, using deity and divinity very carefully, very precisely there. All right, one more.
The divinely perfect creature and the evolutionary perfected creature are equal in degree of divinity potential, but they differ in kind. Each must depend on the other to attain supremacy of service. The evolutionary superuniverses depend on perfect Havona to provide the final training for their ascending citizens, but so does the perfect central universe require the existence of the perfecting superuniverses to provide for the full development of its descending inhabitants.
See, there you have it. Ascending and descending. Okay? So, see, so think about that in direct relationship to what we just said about the supreme. So, the descending inhabitants are very directly parallel to the downwelling of the mother. And we as ascending are parallel to the upwelling of the Almighty. Yeah. You know, the technical thing is, see, that we transition into getting our relationship to the mother when we go into the central universe. Because you fundamentally have that sort of downwelling phenomenon there that you then acquire. So you're, that initial relationship to Almighty sort of gets, you know, incorporated into your core. It was just the scaffolding kind of to get you up there to the central universe so that you could accumulate this relationship to the mother, because you're going to leave as a finaliter, God the Mother revealing. Okay? You know, you have a similar thing with when you think about the Supreme Being. Okay? The power pattern part, the Almighty, you can really think of as becoming the, that's, that you're evolving the body for the Supreme Being. But the personal purposive part, manifest in the finite right now, is the mother. Okay. Okay. See, so you see this, this is a similarity there. That see, you need that really, you need a body, see, essentially first. And then once you have a body, then you can do it, you know, put that body to work in accumulating a relationship to the mother in the central universe. Very parallel to the Supreme.
The two prime manifestations of finite reality, innate perfection and evolved perfection, be they personalities or universes, are coordinate, dependent, and integrated. Each requires the other to achieve completion of function, service, and destiny.
Okay, and that, even though it seems like it's, okay, we've discussed all that, notice one little thing they threw in there just to put some icing on the cake. Be they personalities or universes. This whole, we've been just talking about personalities and super additive consequences of relationships between two different flavors, like perfect and perfected. It's going to be just as true of universes. When the super universes are settled in light and life, each of them will be perfected. And they will have a direct relationship to the central universe as perfect. And there will be a super additive consequence of the relationship between those two universes. Not the beings, literally the universes, the energy. It's going to have a super additive consequence in the first outer space level. See, so not only you know, as a being are trying to get a super additive consequence so that you can transcend, super additive, see? Go beyond perfect and perfected, go up to the absonite, but the universes themselves are going to do this. So those initial things, at least, in the first outer space level are literally going to be the super additive consequence of the relationship of the super universes to the central as things. You know, so things, meanings, values, matter, mind, spirit, you know, this whole synthesis. And you know, they're just reminding you of that just amazing thing to think about. What does that look like? What's this? You know, we know a little bit of the super additive consequence of combining, a paradise of owner with a finaliter and getting one of those Trinitized Sons of Destiny. What happens when you combine a central universe with a super universe? What do you get? Do any of the revelators know? No. Are they really excited to know one day? Trillions of years from now? Yeah, they can hardly wait. It's like, you know, the things that are going to happen, you know. So that they're reminding you that. Remember that when you start to really think about the Supreme, you've got to, you have to bring the power and the personality together. And that all this is happening, you know, in some amazing orchestration of the whole. You know, the automatons and the beings are all doing something together.
Does that have something to do with eventuation?
Right, so what you have there, you know, and she's asking about, for those on the webinar, you know, it has something to do with eventuation. You know, you're thinking about what you build into the foundation of that which is eventuated. you know, eventually all this stuff evolves to completion, and then there's a super additive consequence that establishes a new foundation upon which things are eventuated.
So all becomes new endlessly.
Yeah, right. See, everything changes. The geometry of everything changes. The whole central universe will change. Everything will change. Remember, the whole central universe changed when you established the seven super universes. I mean, it's going to change all again when you get going in the first outer space level. You know, the only thing that's changeless is the aisle. Okay. Havona, you know, the central universe is changing because it's coming down. We're changing because we're going up. And the central universe coming down and the super universe is coming up are going to meet. There's going to be a super additive consequence, as they're reminding you of here. Just like the beings going down and the beings coming up and the mother going down and the almighty coming up. All these things set the stage for the next. All those things go beyond the finite. They're trans-complete. Beyond complete. Whatever that is. All right. Let's take a moment and get ready for next week, because the hits just keep coming.